This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This book presentation, Between the Creeks, My Sapponi Adventures, by Roy A. Cooper, Jr., is made in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Chapter 17, The Heavy Wagon. The long, hot summer day was ending. The sun was beginning to cast long shadows as it slowly sank behind the woods, surrendering its hot rays. With the retreating sun, the rain showers in the late afternoon, and a gentle breeze, I could not have hoped for a more pleasant evening. Even the lightning bugs seemed to be celebrating by flashing their dim lights across the field in front of the porch. Smoke from two old buckets stuffed with burning rags to keep the mosquitoes at bay had a pungent but pleasant smell. Plates and cups were softly rattling in the kitchen as Mother went about her never-ending job of washing dishes. We had finished supper. Daddy was slowly rocking on the front porch in his favorite chair, and I was sitting on the front porch steps. Neither of us spoke, content to hear the whippoorwills whistling their favorite sing-song tune. Whippoorwill, whippoorwill, whippoorwill. To my pleasant surprise, Daddy, who was inclined not to talk very much, said, "This evening reminds me of the evening Papa told me a pretty good story about the Brinkley Hill and two men on a wagon. Want to hear it?" Most of Daddy's private conversations with me were about my need for a college education, so when he offered to tell me a story about the eerie Brinkley Hill, you can bet I responded with an enthusiastic yes. Daddy began, "To the best of my recollection, Papa told it this way, and here's what I can remember about the story. Jeff Henderson and Sam Colley, who lived next door to each other, often drove their two-horse wagons to Nashville to get supplies. I can't for the life of me figure out why people called them two-horse wagons when they were always pulled by mules, but that's what they called them. Sam and Jeff took turns. One time Sam would drive his mules and wagon. On the next trip, Jeff would take his mules and wagon. Both of them were especially proud of their mules, and they were always arguing about whose mules were the strongest. Of course, everybody in the neighborhood thought all four mules were the strongest and best trained in the area. As the story goes, on one of their trips to Nashville, it was Sam's turn to drive. As usual, he drove down the dusty, rutted main street, turning to the hitching post in front of the general store, and tied the mules. A few men were sitting on the boardwalk in front of the store. Sam walked over and joined them. Jeff walked across the street to the Nash Bar, located on the east side of where the courthouse is now. After a couple of drinks of what Jeff called rot-gut whiskey, he went back to the general store. "Let's hurry and get out of here, Sam. It's almost night, and I sure don't want to go up the Brinkley Hill after dark." Over the years, since Brinkley Gandy sold Markham Cooper 500 acres on the south side of Sapponi Creek in 1785, folks have started calling the steep hill that rose just beyond the plank bridge over Little Sapponi Creek the Brinkley Hill. Some mighty scary stories had circulated about it, including tales of ghosts and unexplained sightings. Some folks like Jeff avoided the Brinkley Hill at night, but Sam wasn't too worried. "Oh, I wouldn't fret too much if I was you," Sam said. "I don't think we'll run into any ghosts." He and Jeff quickly loaded their supplies and began the journey home. They followed the path that is today Old Bailey Highway, the same path where the Brinkley Hill is located. They had made a late start from home, and the sun was already down. Sam, handling the old lantern to Jeff, said with a chuckle, "Jeff, light the lantern and hang it on that hook next to the mules. Ain't nobody going to run into us, but at least a little light'll make you feel better. Maybe the lantern will keep the ghosts away." With the lit lantern hung, Jeff joined Sam on the wagon seat, which was nothing but a board nailed down on both sides of the wagon. Two people could sit on that board and place their feet on the floor to give them balance, which helped if one of the wagon wheels hit a bump or a hole. Sam and Jeff rode in silence for a few minutes, then the mules began to trot. The summer had been so hot and dry that the two-track path had cracked the ground in places. Nothing could be heard but the clap, clap, clap of the mule's feet on the hard ground, the trace chains jangling, and the rumble of the wagon. "What's the matter with them mules?" Jeff asked, his eyes darting from one side of the path to the other. "Our butts is going to be bruised when we get home if we don't slow the mules down," he warned. "You know these mules are always in a hurry when they're heading home. They have to be reined in, just like I'm doing now," Sam explained. "Mine don't. I can speak to them in a quiet, gentle voice, and they slow down without me even touching the reins." "There you go again, saying your mules is better than mine. Next thing you'll be claiming they draw their own water at the well." All right, end of argument," Jeff sighed. "But I think something's spooking them mules." Jeff peered into the dark woods on each side of the wagon. Still reining in the mules, Sam kept on. They had passed only four small houses and were pulling up beside the little one-room Elm Grove church situated just a short distance from Saponi Creek Bridge. Suddenly, the mule stopped, heads up and ears back. They were looking straight down the road toward the creek. "What in the world?" Jeff explained. "I told you, old Lordy, I bet them mules seen something or heard something. We're getting close to the Brinkley Hill. You know, Sam, people been talking for years about the Brinkley Hill being haunted, and I'll have to tell you, every time I come by here at night, I'm always a-dreading it." "Now, Jeff, you don't believe them stories, do you? About ghosts and goblins and all that mess?" Jeff's voice trembled a bit when he answered, "Well, I don't know. I reckon I don't believe in haints," the word for haunts or ghosts. "But still, I heard some folks that I know is honest talk about haints around Saponi Creek and the Brinkley Hill." Sam settled the mules down, and they continued past the church and around the curve close to the creek. All of a sudden, the mules stopped dead still, heads held high. Total silence surrounded them for a few seconds, and then they heard the sound like a rainstorm coming straight at them. Wind swirled around the wagon. Leaves flew by, striking Sam and Jeff like hornets. The mules whinnied and stood up in their traces on their hind legs, Sam holding tightly to the reins. Suddenly, the wind stopped still and the silence returned. It had been like a tornado in the middle of a calm. Sam jumped off the wagon, ran around to the mules. "Whoa, whoa!" He rubbed their quivering necks, getting them under control. "What was it?" "Ain't no clouds. Look at them stars. Ain't a drop of rain fell. I tell you, I don't like it," Jeff whispered hoarsely. "Well, it could have been a whirlwind," Sam mused, climbing back on the wagon, doubt and fear creasing his forehead. He clucked to the mules, at the same time tapping them with the reins. The mules still held their heads high, looking one way and then the other. Finally, they obeyed the signal and started across the creek. Just as the back wheels of the wagon rattled off the wooden plank bridge, a shrill, half-human growl came from somewhere down the creek. There was a stunned silence. The frogs stopped croaking, the July flies and crickets stopped their chatter. The white faces of Sam and Jeff gleamed pale in the darkness. The mules went wild. Sam had his hands full, trying to keep them from running away. "What was that?" Sam yelled. "It's got to be them haints we've been hearing about." Sam, nearly out of breath after quieting the mule, said, "Well, it sounded kind of like a bobcat." Jeff yelled back, "What do you mean, kind of like? It sounded like a human to me, or a haint. Let's get up the Brinkley Hill, and I mean fast, too." "Jeff, you and me finally agree on something," Sam yelled. "Get up!" At the same time slapping the mules with the reins. The mules snorted, bent their heads low, thrust their bodies into the harnesses, dug their hooves into the hard, dry ground, and pulled. But the wagon refused to move one inch. "What the?" Sam explained. "Why won't the wagon move? The mules are strong. Something must be wrong with the back wagon wheels. They must be stuck. Jeff, Go back there and see what's wrong. Jeff got the lantern and began to crawl to the back of the wagon, slowly raising the light to get a better look. He suddenly turned pale with fear, dropped the lantern, and opened his mouth to yell. But nothing came out. Finally, he half-stumbled, half-crawled back to his wagon seat. Sam, still struggling with the mules, yelled out, "Jeff, we still ain't moving. What in tarnation's wrong?" Jeff blurted out, "Something black's on the back of the wagon. Something black." Sam's voice was sharp and angry. "What?" All Jeff could say was, something black on the back of the wagon." "Well, give me the lantern." Sam reached with one hand, still holding the reins with the other. "It's gone. The lantern's gone," was Jeff's feeble answer. "Gone where?" Sam almost screamed. "I dropped it when I saw what I seen," Jeff sobbed. While all this was going on, the mules were still pulling, jerking, and pawing so hard that one of the mules fell down and was struggling to get up. Sam threw the reins to Jeff. "Hold the mules, then, and let me go look." Sam felt his way along the edge of the wagon until he got near the back. This time it was Sam whose eyes bulged and mouth went dry. Sure enough, the black thing was sitting on the back of the wagon. Sam scrambled back to the front and croaked, "I believe he was right all along. A haint done got us." Suddenly, the mules fell forward as if a heavy load had been lifted, as if the wagon was empty. Jeff and Sam looked back. The black thing had disappeared. The mules were running away up the Brinkley Hill, but not fast enough for Sam and Jeff. When Jeff and Sam got home, they told the neighbors what had happened, but some of them didn't believe the story. In the morning, they went down to the bottom of the Brinkley Hill to see if they could find any signs of what went on. Sure enough, they found where the mules had torn the ground up with hoof marks. Deep wagon tracks gouged into the rock-hard ground showed where the wagon had stuck at the bottom of the Brinkley Hill. Some of the neighbors were convinced, and some didn't believe a word of the story. Daddy smiled at me with a slow grin when he was finished. "How about you, son? What do you think?" "What I want to know is, what did the black thing look like? What was it?" I asked. "Well, that's for you to decide. I told you all I know. I do know that a heavy wagon story got added to the legends of the Brinkley Hill." Daddy resumed his rocking, and I knew more questions were useless. I decided, all right, I'd never let night catch me alone on the Brinkley Hill. Little did I know that my time would soon come. Chapter 18, My Encounter with Brinkley Hill. Mr. Johnny Cooper, who lived down the road from Pa Fed, had just finished putting in his last barn of tobacco for the year. He and his helpers, who included Dewey Lee and me, were in a festive mood. Mr. Johnny had a pig slowly barbecuing over the coals and iced tea sitting on the table. Dewey Lee and I had been talking all day about going to Nashville to see a movie at the new Myers Theater. We didn't know what was on, but we didn't care. Of course, during my day, parents didn't have to worry about whether a movie had an R rating. The 35 cents Mr. Johnny had just paid us was burning a hole in our pockets, as they say. We didn't have a care in the world, except that school finally started Monday, a week later than scheduled, to give the school kids time to help finish putting in the summer's bumper crop of tobacco. Back then, the start of the public school calendar in Nash County was determined by farmers who needed their children to help harvest the crops. Dewey Lee said, "It's already 4 o'clock. We ignored the barbecue, grabbed a welcome glass of iced tea, gulped it down, and started in a slow trot to Dewey Lee's house. "You know, it gets dark early somewhere around 7:30, he said. "We sure want to get back up the Brinkley Hill and home before it gets dark. Let's hurry and get to my house so we can get this tobacco gum off our hands." That gum is a sticky brown mess that collects on your hands when you're working with green tobacco. After scrubbing and scraping our hands almost raw, we were clean and ready to take off. Dewey Lee grabbed his bicycle and yelled out, "Let's go!" All of a sudden I froze. "Dewey Lee, I left my bicycle at Pa Fed's. I have to go get it." "No, we don't have time for that. Hop on my bike. We can go just about as fast. When I get tired of pedaling, we can stop and trade places and you can pedal. Come on." I jumped on the crossbar, or side saddle as we called it, and we were off. As you can imagine, two people riding on one bicycle on a dirt road is more difficult than it is on a hard surface road, but as long as you rode in the narrow wheel tracks where the dirt had become hard by the continual passage of the automobiles, you were okay. That is, until you encountered the sandy spots. That's when things got tougher. When we got to the Brinkley Hill, we coasted down fast. It wasn't so bad in the daylight. We were on our way, but not before we cast a nervous look back up the Brinkley Hill. I whispered, "See you later, Mr. Brinkley Hill, but it'll be before dark." I didn't know that Dewey Lee heard until he agreed with an amen. Dewey Lee was right when he said that we could stop and exchange places when one of us got tired of pedaling, even though both of us were on one bike. We made pretty good time. We finally arrived in Nashville, left the bicycle in a rack in front of Myers Theater. We didn't have any need for a bicycle lock, and we rushed up to the ticket booth. We fumbled for our dimes, at the same time asking if the show had started. "You're just in time. The main feature has just begun," the ticket lady assured us. "Heck, we missed the previews," I said, shaking my head and looking at the posters advertising coming attractions. "Come on or we'll miss the beginning," Dewey Lee admonished me, exasperated at my dawdling. We stumbled in, stepping on toes, Dewey Lee almost sitting in someone's lap, until finally we found two vacant seats in the dark theater. The show had already started. It was a story of a little girl named Dorothy running into a house trying to get out of an awful storm. She got in the house okay, but it was blown by the wind up in the sky and fell down in a strange land where little people lived. Dorothy wanted to go home so badly that I really felt sorry for her. She finally met up with some strange-looking folks. One was a man full of straw called the Scarecrow. Another was a Tin Man, and the other had a lion head and a tail. They were a funny-looking bunch, but they were nice folks who wanted to help Dorothy get home. Dewey Lee punched me and said, "Boy, ain't this a good show?" I readily agreed. Well, it wasn't long before we began to change our minds. The Wicked Witch of the West appeared. I was apprehensive, but Dewey Lee was terrified. "Let's go," Dewey Lee nervously whispered. "No, not now. We've already paid our good money to see the show, and that's all it is, Dewey Lee, a show." Dewey Lee didn't answer. Finally, the story became so interesting, we found ourselves running up and down the yellow brick road with Dorothy and her strange friends. But every time the creepy, cackling witch appeared, Dewey Lee would move over in the seat a little closer to me, becoming so completely involved that once he even yelled, "Dern you, you witch!" "Hush, Dewey Lee," I whispered, a little embarrassed, and trying to act like I wasn't scared, pretending to be the hero type. As a matter of fact, I was almost as frightened as he was. Believe me, we were both relieved when the Wicked Witch melted. The show finally came to an end, and we agreed that it was the best show we'd ever seen. Dewey Lee and I stretched and slowly walked out of the theater. To our horror, the sun had long gone. It was dark. The movie had lasted much longer than we thought it would. We were absolutely terrified. There was only one way to the safety of our homes, and that was by way of the dreaded night ride up the Brinkley Hill. Dewey Lee jerked the bike from the rack and jumped on. I scrambled to get on the crossbar, and off we went with Dewey Lee pedaling as fast as he could. The full moon began to peek through the thick woods, casting long shadows. A hazy fog floated up from the ground, and the only sound was the bike tires crunching over the dirt road. Neither of us said a word. Finally, an exhausted Dewey Lee said, "I have to rest. I can't pedal no more." We didn't even stop to change places. Dewey Lee just leaned to one side, and I crawled around, took a seat at the handlebars, and began to pedal urgently. We were to make this change several times before we reached home. On one of these exchanges, Dewey Lee looked back over his shoulder and cried out, "I see the Wicked Witch on her broomstick flying across the moon. See? Look! See!" Dewey Lee was panic-stricken. I stole a look over my shoulder, trying to see what he was talking about. It was a bad time to look back. The bike tire swerved out of the wheel track and hit a sandbar. The bike, Dewey Lee, and I tumbled in the sand. To tell you the truth, I thought I saw the witch, too. Maybe it was the power of suggestion. But who knows? We wanted to be brave, and we were, for about 10 seconds. Time enough for us to get really, really scared. Dewey Lee was so unnerved that he pulled the bike out of the sand, jumped on, and started without me. I yelled, "Are you crazy? Are you going by yourself?" That got his attention. Dewey Lee slapped on the brakes, skidded into the same sandbar, and rolled in the sand for a second time. He sat up, spit the sand out of his mouth, and in a shaky voice said, "I'm sorry. I'm so scared I can't think straight." Without a word, I jumped on the crossbar, and we were off again. I soon learned that fear can cause you to act in strange ways. Dewey Lee and I started talking constantly to each other about everything, that is, except our blood-curdling dash toward the Brinkley Hill and the possible confrontation with the Wicked Witch of the West. We tried to fly by Elm Grove Church, but for some reason, just at the bottom of Brinkley Hill, we coasted slower and slower across the creek bridge until we came to a complete stop. Our eyes were wide with terror and fixed on the hill ahead. I whispered, "Just like all them ghost stories we heard about. Everything's so quiet. No noise from the frogs, the crickets, nothing." This kind of talk didn't help either one of us. Dewey Lee, his voice trembling, said, "Let's go back." "Go back where?" I questioned.
"I don't care where. If we go back and try to get home another way, it'll be a day before we get there."
I was trying to calm Dewey Lee. I think that helped me to stay calm.
"It's just a hill."
"I don't believe all those stories," I lied.
"All right, but we'll have to run," Dewey Lee answered half-heartedly. "We can't pedal up the hill, it's too steep, and we'll have to take turns pushing the bike."
We stood at the bottom of the hill for a minute or two, looking up. The moonlight was just enough for us to see ghostly rock shapes and creepy shadows of tall bushes leaning over ditches snaking down each side of the road.
"Enough," I squeaked.
My high-pitched voice startled both of us. I had a fleeting thought of the black thing on the back of Sam and Jeff's wagon at the very place we were standing.
"Let's go!"
We started up the steep hill, me in one wheel track and Dewey Lee and the bike in the other. The Brinkley Hill was so steep that anyone would get tired just walking to the top, much less running all the way. We were so frightened and ran so fast that we were almost there when both of us stumbled to the ground, gasping for breath. After a brief rest, we stood up.
"My legs are shaking so bad I can hardly stand up. But we've got to make it. We're not far from the top."
"If you're ready, I am," I said, almost out of breath.
Suddenly, Dewey Lee screamed. I spun around. He was white as a field of cotton after the first frost, pointing a shaking finger at the bottom of the hill. There stood the Wicked Witch of the West in her old floppy black hat and cloak, her chilling, high-pitched laughter echoing up the creek. We both whirled around, ready to start running. This time, we both screamed. Now the Wicked Witch was dancing around at the top, her piercing laughter echoing off the sides of the hill and down through the woods. Each of us was paralyzed.
I found myself hyperventilating. Dewey Lee was hysterical. He kept saying over and over again, "Oh, Lord, the witch is going to get us. Oh, Lord, the witch is going to get us." I finally gathered enough strength to stagger over to him and yell right in his ear, "Dewey Lee! Dewey Lee, we got to run!" He looked at me as if he were in a trance. I grabbed him in back of the head, pulled his face right up to mine, and shouted, "We can get away from the witch! We can get away from the witch!" Dewey Lee slowly blinked his eyes, shook his head, and asked, "How?" I didn't know how, so I said the first thing that came to my feeble, frightened mind. "We can run up the hill straight at her." His answer was expected. "Are you crazy?" "No, I don't think so. We can't climb up the steep sides of the hill. We could go back down and meet the witch at the creek. Not me. I'm running for home. That's up that hill. I'd rather meet the witch there. At least, that's on the way home." Dewey Lee looked one way and then the other. Between sobs, he nodded his head in agreement, threw his bike in the ditch, and started running with me close behind, toward the witch and the top of the hill. When we got within a few feet of that horrible creature, to our astonishment and joy, she melted. We turned, looked back down the hill, and she was gone from there too, just like in the movie. We both dropped to our knees. I know I said a silent prayer of thanks, and I'm sure Dewey Lee did too. Both of us sat down right there on the top of the Brinkley Hill, perspiration mixed with tears trickling down our cheeks, thankfulness shining in our eyes. "Dewey Lee," I said, "you reckon we really saw what we thought we saw? You know what? It could have been a shadow, and we just thought it was a witch." "And a bird or something could have flown across the moon," Dewey Lee added hopefully. "Well, anyway, if anybody finds out about this, we'll be the laughingstock of the whole neighborhood, and we will be teased to death." Dewey Lee quickly agreed, and we took a blood brother's oath never to tell, like Indians we had seen in a show, placing our wrists together without the blood, of course. We got up to leave. "I ain't going back for my bike this night. I'll get up early in the morning and go get it," Dewey Lee said with a sheepish grin. I really didn't blame him. Dewey Lee and I grew up together and often reminisced about our encounter with the wicked witch on the Brinkley Hill. We kept our oath, however. We never told, I guess, until now. Dewey Lee has passed away now, but I'm sure that if he were here, he'd say, "Okay, you're released from the oath. Just don't say that I was more frightened than you." Heck, I just did. But do you know what he would say to that? "I knew you would." Well, there you have it. Another tale to add to the legends of the Brinkley Hill. Chapter 19. Spare the Rod. In today's world, there is much discussion as to whether corporal punishment is appropriate for children. I'm sure my mother did not decide lightly, but, as you shall see, on occasion her decision came down on the side of the rod. Daddy believed that my education was the most important thing in all of our lives. Well, my mother felt the same way, but her way of motivating me to learn was different from Daddy's. She would try other forms of discipline first, but if they didn't work, she was forced to turn to the old adage, "Spare the rod and spoil the child," as a last resort. It worked. I learned how to study and got the education I remember so well. Daddy was sitting in his rocking chair by the little wood heater reading the newspaper, and Mother was busy in the kitchen. Daddy looked up at me from the newspaper and said, "Time for you to hit the books. I want you to be the best student in the third grade this year." "Listen, Daddy, I already got up my lessons at school," I answered, my eyes shifting a bit at this obvious evasion. Mother yelled out from the kitchen, "Get to the table and start your homework."
We had a big round table that sat in the den dining room. It was used as a dinner table whenever the preacher came for Sunday dinner, but it served as my homework prison during the week. Even today, when Beverly and I serve guests at this same table, my mind flits back to the nightly battles of my youth. Okay, I'm going, Mother, I sighed and sat, reluctantly, opening my books. Boy, was I the great pretender when it came to actually studying. I'd fiddle with the pages, my eyes glazing over, remembering the hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again. No one could tell exactly what I was doing, that is, except Mother. When she saw that I was daydreaming, she would drop the tablecloth, sit down with me, and read the lesson aloud. Then she would ask me questions about what she had read. But I was stubborn. Sometimes I couldn't or wouldn't answer. All right, young man, I can't make you study, but I can certainly make you sit there. Sometimes that approach would work, and sometimes it wouldn't. Many times Mother would sit by me and cry when I refused to do my homework. Seeing the tears rolling down her cheeks, I too would begin to cry. The tears would end with a hug, and by that time I was usually motivated to begin my studies in earnest. But there were times when even her tears did not work. One day I was in a particularly bad mood. Mother called it headstrong. With all Mother's urging, pleading, and crying, I simply refused to do schoolwork. Mother left the room. I grinned, thinking that she had given up. But I should have known better. I continued sitting at the table, daydreaming, and absent-mindedly rolling a little toy truck back and forth over my books, when suddenly a searing, stinging pain flashed across my back. I screamed, looking around to find my tearful mother standing behind me, holding a thin, limber switch. Well, I guess Mother had accepted the wisdom of the instruction, spare the rod and spoil the child. Thank goodness she used a slender switch, not a rod. I got the message, and after that switching and crying scene, she never had to switch me again. As a matter of fact, Mother switched me only 2 times in my life, the third-grade homework switching and the Willie Ed switching when I was 4 years old. I can't see why she did that. It was only the 4th time I had disobeyed her and run away to play with Willie Ed's children. I must admit that I probably needed more than 2 whippings in my younger days, but my mother was kind as well as strict. I know now more than ever that she was the best mother in the world. No telling how I would have turned out if I had not had such loving, motivated parents. It is fitting that I refer to them many times in my writings, for, after all, I've become who I am because of them. The preacher comes to dinner. If the old dining room table could talk or even write a book, it could reveal more of the Cooper family life than I can. For it was around this table that life's problems, large and small, were debated, where laughter was interspersed with serious discussion, where quiet times were interrupted only by the snap of a mousetrap in the pantry and the giggle of the little boy who set the trap. That old table could tell of the merriment of Christmas, the smell of cedar, the squeal of delight and happiness over the second-hand but well-repaired bicycle found under the tree. And the list goes on. Well, old table, I'm going to tell one on you, and I do mean on you. Mother was always involved in church work, and from time to time young ministerial students from Wake Forest College would come down to preach at Elm Grove Baptist Church. The ladies of the church would take turns inviting the preacher to dinner. And remember, that's what we call lunch today. On this Sunday, it was Mother's turn to have the preacher for dinner. She was up before daybreak, cooking and getting ready for the big event. In those days, taking a guest out to a restaurant was unheard of. In fact, restaurants were unheard of. A woman expressed her inner soul in the kitchen, and her talent or artistic skill at preparing a meal was her way of guaranteeing appreciation from her man and from the community at large. At mealtime, she was queen. You can be sure that my mother was always in the race for approval, and you can be doubly sure that she was a safe bet to win. Today's woman doesn't have to depend on the frying pan to make her place in the family indispensable. Whether mother knew it or not, she didn't really have to depend on it either. But cooking was her specialty. Daddy seldom went to church, but whenever we had the preacher for dinner, he was expected to go. Daddy was certainly the boss of the family, but on this issue he somehow knew it was useless to protest. After church on this particular Sunday, Daddy, the preacher, and I were sitting around the old dining room table making small talk while Mother trotted in and out of the kitchen bringing dish after dish of vegetables, ham, chicken, beef stew, biscuits. I know, I've missed a few other dishes, but you get the picture. Mother finally sat down to join us for dinner and asked the preacher to say the blessing. When the Amen finally came, all of us were nearly starving. But just as Daddy reached for the steaming bowl of butter beans to pass to the preacher, Mother jumped up saying, "I forgot the iced tea." She stood up so quickly that she knocked one of the cross braces under the table loose. Then, to our horror, burdened by the weight of so many dishes piled high with nourishment from the kitchen, the old table just gave up. The tabletop buckled, tilting downward like the Titanic, sliding dishes into the laps of Daddy and the preacher. There was a mad scramble with everyone grabbing plates of corn on the cob and fried chicken legs, trying to keep the skidding bowls from hitting the floor. After only one or two dishes had escaped us, Daddy yelled at the preacher and me, "Quick, spread out your arms as wide as you can on the table in front of the food." We followed instructions, and sure enough, that tactic corralled the stampeding dishes and kept them from tumbling to the floor. Daddy slowly moved his knees up underneath the table until it was level. I was then instructed to move a little side table up under the broken crossbeam. That did the trick. The dining room table was level again, and we simply slid our chairs and empty plates around, ready for the feast. No one said anything while Mother gathered baked sweet potatoes off the floor and returned them to the kitchen. Faces were expressionless. Then, after an awkward moment of silence, Mother shyly inquired, "May I pass the butter beans to anyone?" Believe it or not, everybody burst out laughing. I think the preacher laughed the loudest. The very next Sunday, the same young preacher came to conduct the morning service. After the opening hymn, he walked to the pulpit with a grin on his face and said, "As you know, it is the usual practice of the ladies of the church to invite visiting preachers for Sunday dinner. Well, last Sunday, it was my privilege to have been invited to the home of the Miss Lois Cooper family. The meal was simply delicious. I'm a big eater, and I'm sometimes afraid that I'll eat over my share of the food. Well, at Miss Lois's dinner, I did not have this worry. In fact, there was so much food on the table that the table broke down." The announcement was greeted by disbelieving laughter, and then he continued, "It's the truth. And only the quick thinking of Mr. Roy saved a meal that I enjoyed immensely. Thank you, Miss Lois, for a truly memorable Sunday dinner." At this point, the entire congregation turned to look admiringly at Mother, who blushed with pleasure at this public recognition of her kitchen prowess. Remember, I told you at the beginning of this little tale that if the old dining room table could talk or write a book, it could tell you more about Cooper family life than I ever could. You know, I wonder if the old table was jealous and fell down on purpose, knowing that I should at least give it some place of prominence in the Cooper family life. I believe that the old table is now satisfied and won't fall down again within the foreseeable future. We can relax and enjoy our Thanksgiving dinners. Spilt milk. In my early boyhood days, there was little in our pantry that had been bought from a grocery store.
Mother found the pennies for a few luxury items like coffee, tea, salt, sugar, and sometime king syrup. And of course, Daddy, an iced tea lover, always had to make a trip to the ice house in Nashville. 5 cents bought him a 5-pound block of ice, which he wrapped in fertilizer bags and stored under the house, the coolest spot he could find in those hot days of summer. Later, we bought an insulated ice box, which doubled as an end table. That was a real step up the ladder, I thought. I can't remember exactly, but I was at least 8 years old before Carolina Power and Light Company found the way to our house with electricity. Mother and Daddy were a hard-working pair, devoted to their only child and determined to make a better life for me. Daddy, the supervisor of the farming operation, led the pack and never asked anyone to do anything he wouldn't do. On the other hand, my mother was the captain of the household chores. Not only captain, but chief cook and bottle washer and deckhand and any other position you care to name. For example, she washed and ironed all our clothes the hard way. She didn't throw them in the washing machine and dryer or take them to the cleaners. Instead, she built a fire around a heavy black wash pot filled with water to boil our clothes. After rubbing the hot soap clothes on an aluminum washboard and rinsing them in the boiling water, she carefully pinned each item on the clothesline to dry. Ironing came next, but there was no electricity to heat the flat irons. She put them on the stove to get them hot enough to iron out the wrinkles and put a crease in our pants. But washing and ironing were just part of Mother's tasks. Her primary responsibility was keeping food on her table, a job that required endless planning and daily setbacks. For example, preserving summer vegetables and fruits grown on our farm by canning was huge. Remember, we had no freezer. But there were canning hazards that even Mother couldn't avoid. One morning is still fresh in my memory. As usual, before I could open my eyes, Mother's voice floated into my semi-conscious mind. "Time to get up, honey. You gotta milk the cow, and you don't want to miss the school bus." I groaned and rolled over. When I got my eyes adjusted, I saw by the old clock on the mantel that it was just 5:45. "Mother," I yelled, "you're not supposed to call me until 6 o'clock. "I'm sorry, son. The clock in the kitchen must be fast. Anyway, I've already fixed your breakfast, so you won't have to gobble it down." After a long stretch and with great effort, I threw back the covers, pulled on my clothes, and started for the kitchen. "Morning, Mother," I yawned. "I'm hungry. Please pass those good-smelling biscuits." "Well, good morning, sleepyhead," she greeted me. "These are your favorites, sweet potato biscuits. How many do you want?" "I'll take 3, and please pass the butter." That butter, of course, was homemade. At that moment, there was a loud pop on the back porch. "Oh, no," Mother groaned, "not again." We hurried to the screened-in back porch, where Mother kept house-length rows of half-gallon jars filled with corn, butter beans, tomatoes, peas, peppers, pickles, preserves, jellies, and berries of all types. Today's grocery store canned goods shelf had nothing on Mother's back porch display. But this morning, Mother looked with dismay at a half-gallon jar once filled to the brim with freshly cooked corn, now half-empty. Corn was splattered on the floor, on the walls, on the ceiling, and was plastered to the back porch screen. "Tommy, go back in the kitchen and finish your breakfast before you go milk the cow. It'll take me at least an hour to clean up this mess." As I wrote this narrative, I realized I was puzzled as to why some of Mother's jar lids exploded while most of the others did not. So I did some research. I remember that, as a child, I had discussed this matter with several of the mothers in the neighborhood. Some said it was because whatever they were cooking was not cooked enough, or that the lid was sealed too tightly, or not tightly enough, or there wasn't enough space left at the top of the jar for the contents to expand. All of these explanations seem valid, but I wanted to know sure which one was correct. So before I finish this story, I headed for the computer. The answer I found matched one of the neighborhood mother's explanations. Items such as corn and butter beans tend to swell and explode if they don't have enough room. After 80 years, I finally found the answer to my question. After inspecting the cleanup needed on the back porch, Mother and I returned to the kitchen. By that time, the biscuits were cold. I had looked forward to those hot potato biscuits. Sopping molasses with cold potato biscuits and eating cold fatback was not what I had envisioned just before the untimely explosion. While I was finishing my breakfast, Mother was scrubbing my already clean aluminum milk bucket. She filled another sparkling bucket half full of warm water and dropped in two white rags, sterile, I'm sure, to be used to wash the tits and bags of Daisy, our cow. Mother was noted for her absolute cleanliness rule. I didn't realize then just how smart she was. "And you got up 15 minutes early. It's a shame. You had a cold breakfast, and now you've got to rush to milk the cow and get ready to catch the school bus," Mother sighed with disgust. "Don't worry, Mother. I got plenty of time," I assured her. I'd had the milking job for a year, and at the age of 9, I thought I had things under control. How little I knew. I finished breakfast, snatched the two buckets and rags, and hurried down the path toward the cow pasture, grumbling all the way. Got up early. Corn volcano. Cold breakfast. What else? I was soon to find out. As I neared the pasture, old Daisy poked her head over the barbed wire fence, her big eyes following me every step of the way to the corn crib, where I filled a bucket with cottonseed meal and hulls. Old Daisy was free to roam in a big barbed wire pasture with 6 mules. The barbed wire enclosed all of a big 2-story building, except for the front where the doors were located. Although we called this building the corn crib, it should have been called the feed barn. It contained not only corn, but sacks of Red Dog for the hogs, oats, fodder, and cottonseed hulls for the cows, and bales of hay piled high in the loft for the mules. Daisy's feed trough was nailed to the outside of the crib in the pasture. Each morning, I had to leave my 2 buckets outside of the pasture, go in the crib to get a bucket of feed, carry it through the barbed wire fence, and empty it in the trough. I always had to avoid Daisy's pushing and nuzzling attempts to eat out of the bucket as I carried it to the trough. Well, this particular morning, old Daisy saw me coming down the path and jogged over to the feed trough as usual. She looked at me with those big round eyes, constantly licking her lips all around her mouth, walking back and forth from her feed box to the barbed wire fence, where she knew I would be coming with her favorite breakfast. Getting through the barbed wire fence with a bucket of feed was usually enough of a challenge for me. But on this morning, my rush to finish the job and Daisy's enthusiasm for breakfast spelled disaster. As I swung my leg recklessly through the fence, the prickly barbs snagged my pants leg and trapped me. At that very moment, Daisy, impatient for her chow, lowered her head and aimed right for the bucket of cottonseed meal and hulls that I clutched in my hand. But before I could even let loose a useless no, Daisy had her own plans, butted the bucket with a vigorous swoop of her head, sending about half the meal and hulls flying everywhere. Well, I won't tell you what I said as I freed myself from the barbs, but it certainly wasn't appropriate for a little 9-year-old boy. Angrily, I poured the few remaining contents of the bucket into the trough. Then I tried to brush the meal out of my hair and rub Daisy's disgusting yellow cowlick off of my torn pants leg. At that point, completely fed up, I decided to get on with the morning's chore. With one last glance at all that good feed, now useless, scattered all over the ground, I grabbed my 2 buckets from the other side of the fence and pulled up a small 3-legged stool from under the trough. At last, I was ready to do some milking. I washed Daisy's udders and big, puffy bag with the now not-so-warm water and one of the 2 clean rags Mother had provided. Old Daisy just glanced at me with that look in her eyes which assured me, "That water's all right.
this time. I quickly dried her with the other rag. With my little stool in just the right position and the milk bucket placed carefully under Davy's udders, I placed my hands on the two tits and began pulling, first with one hand and then with the other. The milk began making a little sing-song noise as it streamed from each faucet and hit the bottom of the milk bucket. Just as I got my rhythm, old Daisy turned her head and looked at me.
I knew what she was saying.
Tommy, there's a horsefly circling my tail, and I think it's about to land on me. Please, shoo it away. I craned my neck, looking to inspect her rear end, and stood up to look over her back. Nothing. Not even a mosquito. Thinking that I had misinterpreted her look, I sat down and continued milking. However, when my bucket was about half full, old Daisy, using her tail as a whip, lashed my back, simultaneously lifting her right leg and kicking it out with the swiftness and fury of a lightning bolt. The horsefly buzzed off in terror. I jumped back and watched helpless and horror-struck as she gingerly placed her kicking foot smack dab in the bottom of the milk bucket. I went stark raving mad. Not insane, for I knew what I was doing when I hit old Daisy in the side with my fist. I think I just lost my sense of reason. Old Daisy bellowed, ran a short distance from the milking site, looked back at me, her soulful eyes filled with disbelief. I could almost hear her crying. I can't believe you did that. Well, Daisy, I mumbled, I can't believe it either. But you didn't have to put your foot in the milk bucket. Finally, an apprehensive old Daisy, forgiving, hungry soul that she was, walked slowly back to the feed trough and soon began gobbling her feed as if nothing had happened. As I looked down at my half-full milk bucket, I was dumbfounded. Why had Daisy done such a thing? She had kicked the bucket over before, but she had never put her foot right in the milk. Was it an accident, or was it a clever act of retaliation? After all, I hadn't spotted the horsefly on her rump. I would never know, but the primary question at the moment was what I could do about my predicament. I had several choices. I could carry an empty bucket back to the house and incur the wrath of my mother, who was depending on a full bucket of fresh milk to churn our butter for the coming week. I could keep standing there. Or I could go back to the house for a clean bucket, miss the school bus, and probably put my father in a rage. What to do? Hey, I've got an idea. I know exactly what to do, I assured myself. Quickly, I began sloshing the milk around to clean the bucket, turned it upside down to drain every drop of dirty milk, inspected for any telltale sign of Daisy's foot, and dropped down on the stool to milk the other half-bucket I knew Daisy could provide. This is easy, I thought. Mother'll believe I tripped and spilled half of a bucket. At least I can churn half the butter we need, and maybe she won't be so mad with me. Leaving the milking stool and rag bucket propped against the barn, I grabbed the bucket half full of milk and rushed up the path. But as I neared the house, the questions that had been dormant in my mind slowly began to arise. Should I tell Mother that Daisy stepped in the milk bucket? Was the milk safe to drink? What would Mother do if I told her? With these agonizing thoughts, my hurried gait toward the house got slower and slower. If I don't tell her anything, that's certainly not telling her a lie. So what's wrong with that? Nothing. Problem solved. When I reached the house, Mother was standing on the back porch, holding the screen door open for me. The sun was just peeking over the trees, and morning dew was still on the grass. It was a little cold to me, but not to Mother. The whites of her blue eyes were streaked with red. Perspiration was running down her face, pooling around her neck and soaking her dress. "I just finished cleaning up this mess. Corn was stuck all over everything," Mother complained, glancing up quickly for sympathy. Her eyes widened. The sight of me was too much. "What happened to you? Your pants are torn, and your shirt's filthy.
she exclaimed as she grabbed the handle of the milk bucket. The light weight of the pail startled her, and she quickly shifted her attention to the result of my morning's labor, only half a bucket of milk.
"Don't tell me the cow kicked the bucket over again."
"Yes'm," I mumbled.
This is going to be easier than I thought.
"And I suppose it got a little dirt in it, like last time?"
As usual, Mother was right on the money.
I didn't answer. "I know accidents can happen, but this is the third time. You're just careless."
I could tell she was mad.
"Answer me. Did you get any dirt in the bucket?"
"Not exactly." That was safe. It was Daisy, not me, who got the dirt in the bucket.
"There's no not exactly. Did any dirt get in the bucket or not?"
Uh-oh. Bad question. I could tell Mother was really getting mad.
"Not when she kicked the bucket. I held on to it," I ventured.
I knew by the time I said it, the answer was stupid.
"Well, just how did the dirt get in the milk?"
"Mother, the milk's clean. I used half of it to clean the bucket." Mother's voice softened into what seemed to me the low snarl of an attacking tiger.
"Well, just why did you have to wash the bucket with half the milk?"
"Mother, I thought about it all the way to the house. I didn't want to tell you, but I know better than to tell you a lie. Old Daisy stepped in the bucket when it was about half full of milk. I had to clean it out before I could finish milking."
"So, now you think you have a clean bucket of milk?"
"I don't think so." Turning from me in disgust, Mother flung the contents of the bucket into the backyard and whirled around, her finger pointed straight at my nose.
"Get in the house. Take off those torn pants and that filthy shirt. Look in the closet and get a clean shirt and a pair of pants. Don't forget your book sack. Come back down here so I can comb your hair. You don't have but 5 minutes to catch the bus. Move. Now!"
I quickly ran to the closet in the bedroom, dressed, grabbed my book sack, and returned to the kitchen, where Mother was waiting with comb and brush in hand.
"We have to hurry. You'll have to run to Pat's."
The Nashville school bus always picked me up on the road at the bottom of the hill ditches in front of Aunt Pat's. Mother pulled me close and quickly began to comb my hair.
Yes, she still did that, but this time the comb caught in the tangles and spun to the floor.
Mother, at the end of her patience, pulled back her hand and slapped me on the cheek. She had spanked me before, but never before had she slapped me in the face.
We were both surprised, but after the first shock, she put her arms around me and hugged me tightly. I wasn't physically hurt, only my feelings. I felt the way old Daisy must have felt when I smacked her. Both of us blabbled through the tears.
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do it."
She never slapped my face again, although I probably deserved it. She gave me a quick love lick on the fanny, and I jumped off the porch. It didn't take but a few minutes for me to run to the end of the path where Alvin Joyner and Janice and Peggy Cooper had just boarded the school bus. The driver, J.B. Rose, reopened the door, grinned, and said,
"Just a little late, aren't you?"
"You don't know the half of it, J.B., I sighed, sinking gratefully into my seat. As I remember, the school day went well, and old Daisy and I got along just fine, and I continued to do my share of the chores that kept the Cooper farm afloat. But I must admit, I'll never forget that terrible morning. As the years passed, college and law school relieved me of the farm chores I grew up with. Daddy's heart attack reduced him to watching TV or sitting around Cuthbert Watson's store in our old country neighborhood. Mother died at the age of 92, but she never slowed down. Those hands stayed busy until the very end.
We all could use a bit of her stamina.
We have to leave the story for now, but we will continue next broadcast with some more of Between the Creeks by Roy A. Cooper, Jr. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a blind and print-impaired audience and is being made in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Thank you for listening in to The Bookshelf.